Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:30 p.m. Wednesday, May 3rd, 2023. Before we begin, I want to thank Joanna Crossett, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Kelsey Riker from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Kaufman. Senator Giesel is up in Senate Finance. Senator Tobin. Senator Keel is up in Senate Finance, and myself, Senator Clayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business today is Senate Bill 65, Harassment, Sex Offenders, and Offenses, sponsored by the Senate Rules Committee by request of the governor. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee, because I, too, may be called up to Senate Finance at an unknown time. We are going to actually start first with invited testimony. We have some individuals here for invited testimony. I'm not sure who's in the room or who's online, but we have Kim Guy, Director of Office of Children's Services, Department of Family and Community Services. Ms. Guy, are you on? Are you here on the phone? Doesn't seem she's here. Okay, how about Brenda Stanfill? I know you're here. Please come forward for invited testimony. We'd encourage you to keep that comment to about 3 minutes, but since you're invited, we'll probably be more flexible if you need a little
page more. And a half, it's about 3 minutes.
Okay, that's it.
So, Brenda Stanfill, I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I was expecting to come like after there was a full, everything had been explained, so I've abbreviated a little bit of this. I hope that's okay. Much of this bill is updating or fixing areas of law where there seems to be gaps. We're very supportive that someone violating a stalking order could be charged with stalking in the first degree. That seems like it should be. That someone violating their conditions of release would be subject to additional jail time, and that persons required to register as sex offenders have to give more information during registration and let Department of Public Safety know if they will be leaving the state or gone for more than 7 days. We're also very supportive that the crime involving domestic violence be expanded to include unlawful contact and interfering with the report of domestic violence. But what we feel of all of these changes, they'll provide more protections to victims or potential victims of crime. But the most significant change in this bill and what we feel is the most impactful to the victims our 23-member programs work with each day is the change to allow witnesses to summarize the testimony of other witnesses before the grand jury, if the prosecutor believes that the evidence will be admissible at trial. In my years of experience providing direct services to victims, for 25 years I was there providing direct services, I found that the grand jury process is one of the most traumatic events a victim experiences after experiencing the act of a violent crime against them. All felony-level assaults and sexual assault cases go through a grand jury process that currently requires that a victim be physically present to testify. In Alaska, we've worked very hard in the criminal justice process to recognize that the reason we have a criminal justice system is because people are victims of crime. We've attempted to put in place a trauma-informed system that can get the information needed for the investigation from the victim with the least amount of additional trauma as possible. For child sexual assault victims, it's the use of a child advocacy center where they are interviewed by one trained forensic interviewer in a room with all other interested people watching in a close room that has a monitor and is being relayed there by the camera in the interview room. For adult victims of sexual assault, it's creation of the sexual assault response team that consists of an investigator, a forensic nurse, and a victim advocate. They come together to do the interview, so a victim only has to tell their story once and can have access to supportive services during the interview and afterwards. The system then moves away from being a trauma-informed system and can easily be seen as one inflicting trauma on victims. In many cases, when a person is exposed to a traumatic event, the trauma shuts down the episodic memory and the sequences of events gets very fragmented. The trauma being experienced can prevent information the brain is processing to come together to form the entire memory and instead puts the pieces and parts of the memory together. The initial investigation happens at the time that that's the memory that you have. Oftentimes, the memory will start to come together, and by the time they are in front of the grand jury, their individual memories have collected in a more linear process And oftentimes, the difference in the memory between the investigation and the grand jury is used to by the defense to claim the victim is lying. There are also delays in the grand jury. A victim may be told that their case will go to grand jury on Wednesday and to be ready. They spend days gearing themselves up. It's tough. They're going to have to answer questions about horrible things that were done to them in front of a room full of strangers. Then they're told just hours before the grand jury that it's not going to happen. And then it's rescheduled, and then they go through it again. Oftentimes, they're having to travel to the grand jury because it's not in the place that they're located. If they're in a rural area, they're having to come into an urban center. I can safely say from a victim's perspective, there is no part of the grand jury process currently that works for victims. There are cases that never get past the grand jury to an indictment because a victim just cannot tell that story to 18 strangers. We appreciate that this part of the criminal justice system is being reviewed for its impact and efficiency, and we look forward to working with the legislature and the court system for a more trauma-informed approach to our grand jury. Thank you for the opportunity to share.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions from members of the committee. Thank you very much. And Kim Guy is now on the line. Ms. Guy, if you want to identify yourself, your affiliation, and proceed with your invited testimony, trying to limit it to about 3 minutes.
Thank you, Senator Clayman. Good afternoon. My name is Kim Guay, for the record. I am the director of the Office of Children's Services, and I appreciate this time to talk to you about Senate Bill 65. I just want to confirm everyone can hear me.
Hear you loud and clear.
Thank you. I want to talk specifically about 2 points in Senate Bill 65 that is very beneficial to the children and families that we serve. The first part of the bill is the multidisciplinary team response and allowing children to be healed and served at a child advocacy center. And so this provision in the Senate Bill 65 talks about children who have engaged in a sexual behavior with other children under the age of 13. Currently, these are children that are not involved with law enforcement, and they're not involved necessarily with OCS. We take the information at our hotline system, and it's typically screened out because we investigate caregiver or maltreatment abuse. And so for years, we've been trying to figure out how do we serve this population. It's more significant than, how people talk about, you know, kids playing doctor. But it doesn't rise to a level of a criminal or a maltreatment investigation by our agency. And so this is a preventative measure that's no cost that would allow children to be seen at a child advocacy center and served. And so connected to services, whether, it's an 8-year-old child maybe that's had some sexualized behavior on a 6-year-old child. So this is a population, like I said, that's been unserved. And this would meet so many needs and be preventative so these children can get the services, whether it's medical or mental health services. And so we highly support that part of the Senate Bill 65. The other piece of this bill that we are particularly interested in talking about, and I failed to mention I'm also part of the Children's Justice Act Task Force. I should have mentioned that at the beginning. I apologize for that. We also submitted a letter on this bill. But as you just heard previously, the grand jury proceedings is very important in the work that we do. Often when these children finally come forward and tell their story, it's traumatizing to the entire family. There's a lot of emotions in reeling from this, what has occurred and what's finally being told. Children don't have time to engage often in any kind of therapeutic services before they're going in front of a grand jury. And so it does create a lot of hardship to these victims who have been brave enough to finally come forward and share their story. That is in a child advocacy center where people are forensically trained. It's a very specific program that they run at the child advocacy centers that help children share their story in a defensive and culturally responsive method. And so those are the two parts of Senate Bill 65 that I wanted to share some support on.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions from members of the committee. Next, for invited testimony, we have Kristen Benge, investigator of the Department of Public Safety, Ms. Benj, if you want to identify yourself for the record, any affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Investigator Kristen Benj with the State Troopers. Before I go further, I'd just like to tell you a little bit about who I am and how I've progressed to become a trooper. I have a master's degree in public administration. Prior to becoming a trooper, I worked probation and parole in Tennessee on a program supervision unit that was strictly supervising sex offenders and had to testify often and provide sole testimony on when those offenders had new cases coming up. Which brings me to becoming a trooper, where I've worked in the Massey Valley as patrol. I've then moved out to Nome, worked in Nome for several years, and now I'm back on the Child Abuse Investigation Unit. Today, I appreciate you taking the time to hear me and listen to my testimony about why Senate Bill 65 is so important and how it affects the folks that I work with daily. I work at the Children's Place, and you've heard some testimony regarding forensic interviews and how those are conducted, and then those kids are then moving on to give that testimony to the grand jury. Today, I'd like to just put you in a frame of mind of this being your family member or your own child, and have this thought process as I kind of walk through this case that recently occurred. Approximately a five-year-old girl made a disclosure to a safe person in her life, and that prompted the report of harm to go to OCS and then to myself. She came in for a forensic interview, and she described physical and sexual abuse by her father. It's a split home, so goes and stays with dad and then goes and stays with mom. During that process, she gave those disclosures and then later on had some what I would refer to as a trauma response, which affected her whole household as they observed that trauma response after those disclosures. At this point, this kiddo has given that disclosure about three times just to this point. And now under this ruling, she would need to also go before the grand jury. I want you to imagine being this five-year-old walking into this courtroom with all these adults and then going into the grand jury where there's a chair sitting there and it's set up for an adult. So her little legs are dangling and she has a mic that's put close to her face so that her voice is projected for the room. And it's getting recorded. The defense attorney is in their suit, very professional. And now she is looking out at a sea of 12 to 18 people to now tell again her experiences. After she leaves that room, she's able to go back into the safety of that waiting room while she waits to now hear what happens. While working with these families, as we've already heard, it doesn't just impact the victim, it impacts their whole family. And if we can reduce by one time of that kiddo having to give that narrative, it is very impactful to them. By amending this ruling, you're not just providing the prosecutors the ability to make logical decisions about the information being presented to the grand jury, but also reducing the negative impact on the community and the way that they view and navigate our criminal justice system. Furthermore,
we're trying to keep it at about 3 minutes, and you're now over four. I'll give you a little bit more time to conclude, but we are trying to keep some limits on the invited testimony. So if you want to go ahead and conclude.
Absolutely. Thank you. I was told 5 to 7. I appreciate it. I would just like to conclude by saying that amending this ruling provides the opportunity for the grand jury to confirm or deny that the probable cause has been met. And it doesn't negatively impact the people that we're serving coming into that system. And that the information provided to the grand jury is still the same.
Thank you very much. Oh. Senator Tobin has a question.
Thank you. And thank you for your testimony. I just wanted to clarify the age of the example, the age of the child, the example that you gave us.
Yes, the example given of a five-year-old, the way that this is written currently is that the age is irrelevant and that the kid or any victim would have to come before the grand jury.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The last person for invited testimony is Barry Wilson. Mr. Wilson, if you want to identify yourself, state your affiliation, and please proceed. As I noted, we're trying to keep the invited testimony to about 3 minutes.
Thank you, sir. Through the chair, good afternoon to you, my Turnigan neighbor, and the Judiciary Committee members. Thank you for your opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 65. My name is Barry Wilson. I'm the chair of the chairperson for the STAR, Standing Together Against Rape. I'm also a retired colonel of the Alaska State Troopers who worked 30 years for the state, serving Alaskans who were victims of crime, ranging from harassment, domestic violence, sexual assault, and homicide. Further, I have interviewed children and adults who were traumatized by offenders and then continually re-traumatized by the system, which required continual reliving of the traumatic event and the retelling of those events to multiple strangers over years in an attempt to support the legal system that was attempting to hold the offenders accountable. Lastly, members of my extended and close family have been victims of crime. I tell you this to let you know I'm not only work the law enforcement side, but I'm part of the advocate side, but also know the victim's side from a personal level. We have an opportunity to reduce the number of times a victim has to recount to strangers the traumatic events. Each time they do, it is re-traumatizing. As you can imagine, and sadly, some of you may know the trauma of being a victim. Statistically, several of the people on this committee room have been victims themselves, and surely most, if not all of you, know somebody who has been a victim of a crime. As an instructor at the Public Safety Academy on investigations of sex crimes, I would have my students write down something that they were never told anybody else, something traumatic and personal. Maybe I'd ask them to write about their first sexual experience. After a few minutes, I would suggest they share their papers. As you can imagine, the reaction from these type A personalities was not positive. I, of course, told them they didn't have to do this and shred the papers. However, this was their opportunity to see how victims would feel when they come in to retell what had happened to them. Not only would they have to tell the police about this traumatic event, but they'd have to tell the nurse, the prosecutor, the grand jury, and then the jury, judge, and audience, all before they could start the process of becoming a survivor and move on from the trauma. SB 65 removes one of those traumatic events, much like the way we did 30 years ago when we created the Child Advocacy Centers and the Sexual Assault Response Teams in Alaska, reduced the number of times the victim had to report the interview process, repeat the interview process again and again. Today, that process is used to produce a quality recorded interview and a video that is used currently in grand juries. However, the victim still is required in Alaska to go to the grand jury and provide the same information again, to relive the event again. In 29 other states and within the federal system, this is not the case. Law enforcement is allowed to provide information and or introduce the recorded statements of the victims at grand jury. Alaska has some of the highest rates of sexual assault, child abuse, and domestic violence in the country, yet we make it difficult on victims to indict these cases. Everything we know about trauma tells us not to make victims relive it again and again. Dragging victims into court an extra unnecessary time makes just days after the event increases the traumatization of the victim of these worst crimes. Most states don't do this, and we are the minority. And it means that most vulnerable victims, rural victims, unhoused victims, and the most severely physical and psychologically injured victims are less likely to have their cases prosecuted because of the massive resources it takes to find them and bring them to the grand jury, and the massive toll the trauma takes on them. It also imposes huge costs on the court, law enforcement, and the prosecution, and most especially the victims themselves.
It is unnecessary and leaves victims worse off. At the turn of the 1900s, there was no crime of child abuse. The first child abuse case was tried as cruelty to animals. We have come a long way in the last 100-plus years, and I believe it is time we turn a new page on this century and supporting victims of crimes by not re-victimizing them. Let's not make them recount the events where it is not necessary and allow the information to be provided in another manner a grand jury. I really thank you for your time and all the efforts you're making in this manner.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions from members of the committee. That's the last with the invited testimony. This time we're going to open public testimony on Senate Bill 65. Is there anyone in the room that would like to provide public testimony on Senate Bill 65? I would note also for committee members, in addition to Mr. Skidmore, who's going to provide some thoughts later, Casey Schroeder is here, Lisa Purinton, acting legislative liaison with the Department of Public Safety, is here, and Cornelia Sims with the Alaska State Troopers, I think, is probably online. I don't think he's in the room. But we are open for public testimony. I don't see anyone in the room. First person I believe is online is Samantha Mins-Gentz. Ms. Gentz, if you want to identify yourself for the record, we're going to limit public testimony to 2 minutes per person if you want to proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Samantha Mins-Gentz. I'm from Anchorage. I'm representing STAR, Standing Together Against Rape. I speak today regarding Section 12 and the accuracy of children's statements as well as their well-being as a victim witness. The policy statement by the American Academy of Pediatrics titled The Child Witness in the Courtroom addresses the negative impacts of testimony on children victim witnesses. The AAAP cites the long-term consequences as of 176 children interviewed 12 years after testifying. The evidence shows that testifying repeatedly, as would occur if they need to for grand jury and then trial, was associated with worse mental health outcomes, and testifying about severe abuse had higher levels of trauma-related problems. The AAP notes that testifying more than once is associated with long-term mental health problems. Shielding procedures such as a two-way video is less stressful on children and provides more accurate and detailed information than it would be had they testified in court in front of a jury. Mock trials indicate that juries do not provide different verdicts when using video systems, while some studies suggest that jurors are actually less likely to believe children witnesses who give shielded testimony. I bring this note up as some defense attorneys might say that it gives the jury a bias. It appears that it actually goes in the opposite effect. The AAP recommends that a supportive interview provides accurate information. They also recommend that only individuals with qualifications and experience working with children witnesses be allowed to question children. This would disclude grand jury members from directly questioning minors, as they are able to do today. And that's all. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions. Next in the queue is Keely Olson. Ms. Olson, if you want to identify yourself, any affiliation, and please proceed.
Thank you very much. Through the chair and to the committee members, this is Keely Olson. I'm the executive director of STAR in Anchorage. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. It's been a while since I've done a grand jury. I'm more in the administrative end of things here at STAR, but I did want to recount one grand jury that really stuck with me, as some of them do. I was working with a six-year-old boy and his family. He had been the victim of child sexual abuse, and his father walked in and caught the offender in the act and, I believe, beat him within about an inch of his life. And I was at the grand jury with that child as he was preparing to testify, and we were playing a game of war in the waiting room outside the courtroom, and he was holding up pretty well. And then his father went in to testify, and his lips started trembling, and he started shaking, and he asked me, "Do I really have to do this? I don't want to do this. Can't my daddy do it? He's bigger. I'm just little." And I had to explain to him that, no, he did have to go in. He did have to relay what had happened to him. Although he had been through a children's advocacy center and he had explained to law enforcement and he had done everything that he had to do and his father witnessed what happened, he did have to go in and he had to testify. And as a victim advocate, you know, we have to go through some mental gymnastics where we're trying to think of some way that this is empowering to a child. You know, we're trying to convince ourselves that what we're doing to this child is okay. And I'm just here to tell you that it's not. It's unnecessary. You know, as Barry Wilson stated, 29 states don't hold grand juries. It's not a constitutional requirement. It's an added burden that the state has taken on. The state has invested so much money in CERT teams and in children's advocacy centers in being victim focused.
Ms. Olson, you're about at the 2-minute mark. If you would conclude your remarks, that would be great.
STAR supports this bill in its entirety, but especially in regards to survivors not having to testify at grand jury. Thank you very much for your time and your consideration.
Thank you very much. Next in the queue is Amber Chung. Ms. Chung, if you want to identify yourself for the record and any affiliation you may have.
Good afternoon and thank you. My name is Amber Chung. I'm speaking today on behalf of myself. But I will note that I'm a forensic interviewer and social worker who works closely with our local CAC. I feel that others before me have explained the benefits of Senate Bill 65 in great detail, so I'll keep this pretty short, but I would just like to add my voice in support of this Senate bill, especially as it pertains to protecting from the re-traumatization and duplication in respect to grand jury testimony of minors, expanding CAC MDT scope to include providing services to children under 13 who are engaging in problematic sexual behaviors, and also for the in-state registration of sex offenders. That is all. Thank you for your time and for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Next in the queue, we have Devin Cunningham. Ms. Cunningham, if you want to identify yourself, any affiliation, please proceed.
Hi, thank you. I apologize. I'm not going to sound as polished as the other people, as I just heard about this bill being considered about half hour ago. My name is Devin Cunningham. I'm a retired officer with the Anchorage Police Department with almost 26 years of service. 17 of those years were with the Crimes Against Children's Unit, where I literally interviewed thousands of children. I also was an instructor. I would like to also add my support to this bill. In my experience, children who have to testify are not only terrified of it, but I think they are harmed by it. The reason we have CACs in Alaska is to lessen the trauma. During the CAC interviews, as many of you may know, it is recorded on a DVD so that anyone who wants to look at it not only hears the kid's voice, but can see their body language. And I think this is an important note to make, because these interviews can be played in the grand jury, and instead of testifying, the child testifying. So essentially, in my experience, dealing with kids and having to sit with them before they testify, I think that it's important to consider this bill a passage and understand that the dynamics of this go way beyond just what happens at the court. The kids are traumatized. The parents are traumatized to the point where they may not want to continue with it, even though it's in the child's best interest because they don't like seeing their kid traumatized. So in conclusion, sorry, I just want to add my support to this bill as well.
Thank you very much. Next in the queue, we've got Vicki Jo Kennedy. Ms. Kennedy, if you want to identify yourself for the record, any affiliation, and please proceed.
Yeah, good afternoon. My name is Vicki Jo Kennedy. And I'm still here in Juneau, and I'm representing myself. And I am in total support of this bill. I am literally appalled that a 5-year-old child had to go before a grand jury. I mean, I just heard this, and this is the first time I heard it. It was, you know, minutes ago. But as a victim myself, several years ago. It's hard. It's hard when you go to the emergency room, and then it's hard when you have to do it. But again, for an law officer, an officer of the law. And for myself, that's where I drew the line. I said, no, I'm not going to do this. No, I'll get through it. And I think there's a lot of women, and we know the children must do the same thing. Just say, no, I can't do this. We know that Alaska has the highest, and I know it's per capita of sexual assaults in the country, and probably some of the highest in, you know, the world. But I am in total support of this bill, and I appreciate all the people from STAR. And Officer Devin, thank you for those years, 17 years of hearing that. That's incredible, but thank you guys, and thank you for hearing this bill. And Godspeed.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions. Next, we have Suki Miller. Ms. Miller, if you want to identify yourself and affiliation, please proceed.
Hi, my name is Suki Miller. I am the Executive Director at Victims for Justice. Thank you for allowing me time to speak today. I'm calling in favor of support SB 65. As people have already mentioned, it reduces the re-traumatization of victims of violent crime. It is frustrating that we do have victim rights in statute and in the Constitution, but they really don't have a whole lot of teeth, and it's kind of a slap on the wrist if they are not followed. But then to also turn around and require victims of violent crime to testify at grand jury just furthers the traumatization of victims in our legal system. Our legal system can provide justice and healing, but by re-traumatizing victims, it's not doing it. Ensuring victims receive the rights they are supposed to be guaranteed is. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. I don't have anyone else in the queue. I don't see anyone in the room who's arrived since I last asked. So unless I see somebody else walk in momentarily, and I don't, we're going to close public testimony on Senate Bill, I better get the number, Senate Bill 65. I think that brings us next to Mr. Skidmore. Welcome back to Senate Judiciary. And I'll give you about 5 minutes to provide wrap-up, but I would ask in your addressing that there was some testimony about people under 10 testifying in front of the grand jury, and I know in the existing rule there's hearsay exceptions for children under 10 hearing the hearsay testimony of children under 10. So I would appreciate your perspective on if there's already hearsay exception, why were these youth being asked to testify? And then the other area I was curious, whether telephonic parts of the rules that allow telephonic testimony and potentially video conference testimony would allow children that were over 10 to be able to testify today. And if you could address those in your comments, that'd be great.
Good afternoon. Excuse me. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. I recognize that this is the second hearing for the bill, and you all had an opportunity to hear from the Criminal Division Director who works for me at the last hearing. Apologize, I couldn't be here myself. I was called out of state for other business. SB 65 really does six things, and I'm going to recap that. And once I've recapped that, I'm going to turn to the questions that Senator Klayman's asked me to address specifically about grand jury.
Make your recap fairly brief, because we got a very very detailed presentation by your associate, and
not looking to do anything very detailed. I was asked to do a recap. It's meant to only be that. There are six things that the bill does. The first one deals with grand jury. We're going to come back to that one. The second one talks about requiring out-of-state offenders, sex offenders, to register if they move into the state, and adjusting some of the additional information required for sex offender registration. The third thing it does is that it adds a violation of a stalking or a sexual assault protective order to stalking in the first degree. Currently, the only protective order in stalking in the first degree is a domestic violence stalking order, protective order. And so it just takes these other two types of stalking orders and adds it to that stalking in the first degree. The fourth thing it does is it allows CACs to be able to interview children under 13. I believe you heard Ms. Guay talk about the importance of that and how that can provide services to those victims or to those children under the age of 13. The fifth thing it does is that it requires consecutive sentencing for violation of conditions of release, so that if you have multiple instances of violations, they run consecutively instead of having them all run concurrently. And then last but not least, the sixth thing it does is that it amends the definition of domestic violence to add two additional crimes to the list: unlawful contact in interfering with the report of domestic violence. Just to put that into context for you all, in order for a crime to be considered a crime of domestic violence, Title 18 lists the type of crimes that qualify, as well as the type of relationship that had to exist. This is just adding those two additional crimes to that list of the offenses that qualify as a crime of domestic violence. Those are the six things the bill does. At this point, I was going to turn to the questions from Senator Klayman and come back to the grand jury portion. Really what the changes for grand jury does is that it allows the evidence gathered in an investigation to be summarized at the time of grand jury. It's not as though someone's sort of just making something up. The investigator has gone out, gathered the information, and it simply allows it to be summarized. This does not implicate any constitutional rights. The summary of testimony does not implicate any constitutional rights. And that was one of the things that I had heard a little bit in the last hearing. I wanted to make sure that everyone was clear. There are no constitutional rights implicated by making this change. The second thing that I wanted to note is I had also heard from the last hearing that the rule change is being requested here in the legislature instead of through the Rules Committee. I just want to note for you all that I'm sure some of you know lawyers. Some of us are lawyers. The Rules Committee, as I believe Senator Klayman pointed out at the last hearing, is made up of 13 lawyers. So I ask you to imagine yourself sitting in a room with 13 lawyers and asking you, how long do you think it's going to take 13 lawyers to come to an agreement on anything? They meet three, four, sometimes five times a year.
Mr. Skidmore, you're going to ask that question, and I've been in rooms with more than 13 lawyers, and I've seen when lawyers want to, they get stuff done sometimes much faster than the legislature. You do that in your office every day. You get things done much faster than the legislature.
Mr. Chair, competing against the speed of the legislature is not necessarily much of a high watermark.
I agree. All right, please continue, Mr. Skidmore. You're asking a question, and I think it begs an answer, and I think your answer, the answer you're hoping for isn't necessarily very compelling, at least with the chair and perhaps others on the committee.
While I can appreciate that it is possible to get things done quickly, I would tell you that historically, any of the Rules Committee that you look at that sit for the Bar Association, particularly the ones that deal with these, it takes them 18 months to 2 years to get anything done on any of the rules that come before them, although I appreciate your point. The other thing that I would like to note, however, is that the change that we're talking about for grand jury right now was a change that was made back in 2005 when there was a direct rule change, just like this one, made in a previous piece of legislation that was sponsored by Hollis French. That piece of legislation was ultimately passed in 2000. It started as SB 117 and was rolled into HB 53 in 05, and it was passed back in 2005 unanimously by both the House and the Senate at the time that it was. There was a case called Powell, which I think you all have heard a little bit about, and I want to be clear that one of the other things that Powell talks about, both on page 611 and on 615, is that it says the legislature did not amend this particular rule, and so the courts, the Court of Appeals, is inviting the legislature to say, if you intended this rule to be amended, then you should amend it. There's two different quotes in the opinion that talk about that, and so I think that's another thing that's important to be addressed here. That then takes me to the questions that Senator Klayman asked just a moment ago. Chair Klayman, you were asking about individuals having to testify when they are under the age of five. Powell has, in fact, called into question the ability to have testimony played by video, even when the children are under the age of 10. That's part of the problem we have because of the language in Powell that it talks about other requirements that exist. That continues to be a problem for us and is part of the reason that we're trying to address this. And the second question that you would ask me to address is the ability for telephonic testimony.
Well, we'll go back.
Sure.
The question I asked, you didn't really answer that question.
Okay.
Which is under the existing rule, which is actually set out in the bill because it's language you're deleting. It specifically says a child under 10, there's some provisions for providing hearsay testimony.
Yes.
Which is really not the video. That's not the video replay of a prior video, but that's one in which another witness is able to provide the hearsay testimony of the child. And so we heard testimony from a couple of folks on the both the invited testimony and I think also the public testimony about child witnesses under 10 who were for whatever reason, it seemed like they were required to testify. And I'm asking you the question about, given that existing rule allowing hearsay presentation, why wouldn't they present that by hearsay to avoid the trauma on the victim?
I apologize, Chair Klayman. I thought that I was answering that question directly. The Powell case calls into
question. But that doesn't answer my question, because they're talking about cases historically, but the Powell case is very new, correct?
The Powell case occurred in 2019.
Okay. So I'm assuming that some of the testimony that was described involved cases before the Powell case. Powell may change that, but before the Powell case, I mean, in 2015, why would you have a five-year-old victim testifying live? Why wouldn't you have that person testifying? Why wouldn't you present that person's testimony by hearsay?
You're absolutely correct, Chair Klayman. The Powell case was in 2019, and prior to that, all of that was done by video testimony. The example you heard from Investigator Binge is actually a case pending right now today. It is something that happened since 2019. I heard a comment from testimony, I believe it was Keely Olson, who had testified. I don't have any information about that particular case. I don't know the timing of when it occurred. I can't tell you if that was prior to 2005 when the enactment was allowing this to occur. That is the plain of summary of the testimony. I don't know if that's something that happened since 2019.
That's fine. As to the Powell case, is your testimony the Powell case specifically prohibits the hearsay testimony of a child under 10? Or does it simply raise questions about it?
It has raised significant questions about it. I think the Powell case itself dealt directly with a victim who was 14, so over the age of 10. But I think it has also raised questions about this particular provision. And we're trying to clarify all of this. But beyond that, the provision that's there right now, if you look at victims that are simply under 10, I would submit to you all that there are many, many more people, victims that are over the age of 10, including adults, that are also re-traumatized by this process. And I'll be very clear, the proposal in front of you goes much further than what was introduced in 2005. No qualms about that. That's absolutely the case. But that is based upon having to look at what was decided in Powell, talking about trying to fix the system, and then looking at that bigger picture of saying, you know what? We're in the minority in how we approach this. Why are we continuing to traumatize our citizens in the way that they have to present this testimony? Why not give all citizens this benefit? Because it's clearly constitutional. It's done by the federal government. It's done by 29 other states. Why wouldn't we follow suit? Okay. And then to your last question, Chair Klayman, as you had asked me about telephonic testimony. I believe I heard someone talk about people having to travel in order to testify at the grand jury. You are correct that there is a court rule that says if someone lives more than 50 miles away, they can testify telephonically. I, however, will also tell you, having worked and lived in the Dillingham office, which is a remote part of the state, and we did all of our grand juries telephonically because they had to be done in Anchorage, what my experience was is that when you have young children having to testify, having them do that telephonically is not easier than having them there in person. It is easier to try and help a child walk through this when you can see them, when you can interact with them, and that body language becomes important. I would note that this change that is proposed by SB 65 is not a mandate. It does not say there can never be victim testimony or witness testimony for those specifics. It simply gives the authority. It authorizes that summary to occur. But there may still be cases in which prosecutors would say, you know what, there are certain cases where it's important to hear from particular witnesses, and that's not in any way infringed upon. It just allows us to avoid that in most of the cases, which is where I think there is the benefit, not only to the individuals, but quite frankly, to the grand jurors. I can tell you, I have heard from numerous of my prosecutors when they talk with grand jurors and victims have had to come in and testify. We actually have grand jurors that are visibly upset with us and come and accost our prosecutors afterwards, very frustrated that we would have forced somebody to go through that. And that puts us in the position of having to explain, you know, when this is happening, this is what the law requires. So I think that there is significant support both from victims, as you heard in the public and invited testimony, as well as from the grand jurors themselves, think that this type of a change is an appropriate change, and I would encourage you all to give it serious consideration.
Senator Tobin has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, and I'm going to go back to the State versus Powell cases. I'm just a little confused. The person was 14 years old. The current rule that I'm looking at, the 6R, indicates that a child under 10 is excused or has the ability to submit hearsay evidence, but above that age, why didn't the 14-year-old go to the grand jury? What was that decision-making process? It seems like it was done with intent.
There is another rule. It's an Alaska evidence rule, 801D, that talks about hearsay, which is an out-of-court statement. And there is an exception in that 801 that allows what would otherwise traditionally be considered hearsay, that there's an exception to it. And so it was using that 801 to say, we believe there is an exception in the evidence rule that would allow us to play this particular testimony. And what happened is the Court of Appeals in Powell said, no, that particular rule applies to trials. We don't think that that applies to grand jury.
Follow up?
Senator Tobin.
So with that being understood, so obviously this is an issue that the courts have identified, why would the recommendation be a wholesale change and not just simply changing the child under age 10 to the child under age 18? Why remove all this other language, including and not limited to the individual presenting the hearsay evidence as a peace officer, as that was quite a bit of the testimony we heard in the introductory bill hearing, is around how valuable it is to have a peace officer provide that information. And of course, being married to a federal law officer myself, I understand the training that he goes through. I understand the observation training, the ability to compartmentalize and so on and so forth. So I can understand why that would be within the court rule. But yet now all of that is being removed simply to insert a provision that the prosecutor believes. And I don't know enough about prosecutor training, but I definitely know quite a bit about federal law officer training. And I would think that understanding that component and having value in that and the statement of a belief, I find some discrepancy there. So I'm just curious on that provision. Why is all of it being removed and not just the very specific changes as identified by Powell?
Thank you. Through the chair to Senator Tobin, the answer to your question is all of that other language which is being removed are various limited hearsay exceptions that were identified in the rule. The way that this is drafted is that it's much broader, and it says the prosecutor has to believe the information is going to be admissible to trial. Not believe the information is true, believe it would be admissible at trial. And then we would solicit that information, as they do in the federal system, from the law enforcement officer who is summarizing it. It doesn't specify that it has to be the law enforcement officer, but if not the law enforcement officer, I'm not sure who would be the appropriate person to summarize. It did not feel necessary to put that particular concept within the rule to make it make sense, but that's exactly what the intent here is. To answer your more specific question about why not change just some of these smaller things, if the decision is made by the legislature that they don't want the provision to be as broad as it's currently drafted, then you are correct. You could simply take the exceptions that are there, and you could broaden it with the age of the child, and you could say you want to make that age higher. You could say instead of being the age of a child, you could say for sex offenses or for domestic violence. You can pick which crimes it is you think a summary should be applied to. You may say you don't think it should apply to everything. You think that somebody that's a victim of a vehicle theft still needs to come in. I would argue with you that that person of a vehicle theft should not have to take 2 to 3 hours out of their day for 60 seconds worth of testimony, but that's a policy call that you all certainly can be making, and that could be limited if that's something that you all were interested in.
Follow up. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, and I appreciate that, and you mentioned policy call, and so I'm looking at this, and this is a pretty big, broad policy call on behalf of
sure.
the Department of Law, may I ask why you think this is the best approach?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, this approach, as I've indicated previously, is the approach that the federal government takes in handling their grand juries. This is a similar approach to what we've seen 29 other states doing in the way that they approach things. This is something that creates more efficiencies within the system. I know at the last hearing, you all heard some about the backlog from COVID-19. And while it's certainly true that it would help with that, I think that that misses the mark if you only look at COVID-19. When you talk about having to subpoena witnesses to grand jury, you're talking about us having to find all of the various witnesses that we want to call in, issue subpoenas for them, have those subpoenas issued for those people, have them come into grand jury, and if for any reason the grand jury is delayed or rescheduled, you're now interfering with all of those folks' time and their daily lives as well. Whereas if it's simply the summary, you're dealing typically with one witness, the investigating officer. As you describe your husband being a federal officer, for us it would likely be a law enforcement officer with the Alaska State Troopers or with one of the municipal agencies. One witness who's going to come in and say, I was in charge of this investigation. These are the people I spoke to. This is the information that I learned. And that allows the grand jury to assess all of that information and say, do I think the investigation that was done here and the information that was gathered, is that sufficient for this case to move forward to the next step? And that next step being then the pretrial process and ultimately a trial, now we absolutely have to call everyone. That is a constitutional right, the right to confront. And that's not changing at all. But for grand jury, it's trying to say what really needs to happen for grand jury. And the concept is the citizens are supposed to decide, do they think there is sufficient evidence for this case to move forward? And the reason it's submitted the way it is the most efficient way to do that is to simply to allow the officer to summarize. And that summary is recorded, is provided to defense counsel, and defense counsel gets to say, I think the officer got something wrong in the summary. I think the officer mischaracterized something. And if they think that's the case, just as they could now, they would file motions to challenge that indictment or the determination of the grand jury, and courts would look at that. And if it was said the officer got it wrong, we might very well have to go back and redo that grand jury. But the idea is to try and make it more efficient and more effective, and that respects the rights of victims that have been subject to very traumatizing crimes, such as sexual assault, such as sexual abuse, such as some of the domestic violence cases. And it also provides consideration and respect even for those people that are simply the subject of a property crime where they typically don't know the person. Vehicle theft, 4 questions. What's your name? Is this your vehicle? Do you know the person who was caught in it? Did you give them permission to drive it? That's it. And yet they will have to take sometimes 2 or 3 hours out of their day to answer those 4 questions. They already went through the hassle of having their vehicle stolen. Now we're going to put them through all of this again just to try and get justice for that. That's the sort of thing that I sort of bang my head against the wall and I think, is that really what victims and the citizens of the state are interested in? So that's the policy call that's in front of you.
Yes, and I appreciate that. And I really appreciate your passion. I tend to also believe that folks who are accused of crimes are innocent until proven guilty. And it sounds the way that you're presenting this is the burden of proof is put onto the person who's being accused and not necessarily onto us. And so I might have a difference of a call here. I am not as well-versed as some of the lawyers that happen to sit next to me or some of the lawyers that are in this room. And that's why I have great consternation around making such a wholesale change, as I feel like this should fall within the purview of the courts, and particularly with making decisions around Rule 6 R. And that's just where I happen to fall on this particular issue.
So I don't see a question from Senator Kaufman. We talked earlier about telephonic testimony. Is the process of some of the adjustments during COVID, were you all taking video, not recorded video, but video conference testimony in grand jury, kind of live video presentations? And was that as a permanent court rule? Was that a temporary court rule? What are the, I mean, when you, like, for example, when you talk about the person with the auto theft case that needs to testify for 60 seconds, what's the story on video testimony? live video testimony is distinct from recorded.
Thank you for the chair. Thank you for the question, Chair Klayman. The answer to your question is that during COVID, there were limited exceptions that were allowed for some video presentation, streaming video, not recorded, streaming video presentations for grand jury. None of those have been permanently put in place, so that is not a possibility as we sit here today. That would require a rule change of some sort to authorize that sort of testimony to occur.
And then I'm just struck with your testimony about the Powell case, which I have read briefly and need to study further, but your observation that this goes to the admissibility of hearsay evidence in grand jury, I mean, isn't the potentially the simplest way to address this just to modify the criminal rule that basically allows hearsay evidence to be presented to the grand jury in the same way it's admissible at trial? Wouldn't that be a simple way to address the Powell, to whatever questions are raised by Powell? And I do need to study it more, but to some extent, if they're suggesting that you can't, there's some limits on hearsay evidence in grand jury that don't apply at trial, doesn't it become simpler just to modify the rule to say that you treat hearsay the same at grand jury as at trial?
Chair Klayman, it's an interesting question. Part of the analysis in Powell is that at trial, there is a defense attorney, there are questions that can be asked by the defense attorney, and there were other conditions that were established for that hearsay exception that the court found did not equally exist at grand jury. And so if you were to simply say admissible at trial, therefore admissible at grand jury, I think could still limit the ability because of the differences between grand jury and trial. But I get the concept that you're describing, and I think that it could be possible to craft language to try to get there, but I don't think as you've described it initially, I don't think that language would work. But I understand the concept, and that is, again, something that could be done. It's not unlike what I was describing to Senator Tobin. If the committee or the legislature is uncomfortable with a change as broad as this, I think there are more limited changes that could be crafted and put into place.
Okay. I think those are all the questions that I had. I don't see any other questions from members of the committee. Thank you very much for joining us today. We are going to hold Senate Bill 65 for further review, and we're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Friday, May 5th at 1:30 p.m. We will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:28 p.m.